From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Well, if there's any uniformity here, we'd have NATO bombing Jakarta. But that won't happen. They won't be bombing Istanbul either, or all the other places that the West and the U.S. support.
Journalists John Pilger from London and Robert Fisk from Belgrade on bombing and hypocrisy. Manning Marable reflects on race, the Colorado shootings, and this weekend's mobilization for Mumia Abu-Jamal. And on this Earth Day, Clinton and Gore on the hot seat over global warming. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. NATO is confirming a hit on a presidential command post in Belgrade. However, an official says the alliance had no information. The building was used as a residence by Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. The state-run news agency says Milosevic's main residence was destroyed by a missile attack overnight. The report says he and his family were not at the home at the time. The gutted shell of the columned white building was shown on Serb TV. NATO may be opening the door to ground troops in Kosovo. NATO chief Javier Solana says at the same time, he says he has authorized commanders to revise and update plans for possible ground forces. But he insists no decision has been made. In an interview with Associated Press TV News, Solana says the alliance is sticking with their air campaign against Yugoslavia for now. And before President Clinton sends ground troops to Kosovo, he'd better clear it with Congress. That's what Americans are saying in two new polls. 80% of those questioned in an NBC Wall Street Journal poll feel that way. President Clinton must seek the approval. In the NBC poll, close to three-quarters believe Clinton is reacting to events as they occur rather than working from a long-range plan for Kosovo. And two-thirds believe NATO misjudged Yugoslavia's ability to withstand airstrikes. Conditions like El Nino might settle in almost permanently if global warming gets bad enough, making climate disruptions such as droughts or excessive winter rain essentially the norm, this according to a computer study. That might happen around the year 2050 if nothing is done to control emissions of carbon dioxide and other heat-trapping gases, according to the Max Planck Institute for Meteorology in Hamburg, Germany. The computer simulation suggests unrestrained global warming could set up the same kind of pattern in ocean surface temperatures, but as a more or less constant condition. Meanwhile, also on this Earth Day, France's official nuclear watchdog agency, the Institute for Nuclear Protection and Security, says that despite improvements, the plant still has serious security failures and should be closed down as soon as possible. This is the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, which will continue to operate until the West provides money promised to complete two nuclear reactors, according to Ukraine's president. President Leonid Kuchma's statement came just days before the 13th anniversary of the world's worst nuclear accident. And back in this country, yesterday, 67 students at the University of Arizona at Tucson staged a sit-in at the campus administration building, taking over the president's office to protest the use of sweatshop labor for the manufacture of university apparel. The group, Students Against Sweatshops, is part of a broadening movement of university students around the country that are demanding that their administrations adopt a set of standards that guarantee sweatshop-free products. We go now to the University of Arizona, Tucson, to the sit-in, where we're joined by student James Cook. James, can you tell us what's happening and why you're there?
Well, we're pretty high in energy here. It's just 6 o'clock in the morning here, but our action is the culmination of 2 years of work that we've done building a broad coalition against sweatshops. We're really just asking for 4 simple things: public disclosure of factory locations so we can know where they are, independent monitoring, a living wage, and women's rights of workers in these factories. Now, we think these things aren't exactly revolutionary, right? So they're basic human rights everyone should be entitled to, and we just can't understand why anyone would reject these points, but that's what the administration's done. He's been rejecting these points for 2 years, talking and talking again to us, just keeps rejecting, so we had no other choice but to occupy the building and force the issue, and we're prepared to stay here until he signs our resolution and puts an end to this issue.
James Cook, we have been covering the anti-sweatshop protests all over the country at universities. Are you part of a national coalition, your group?
We certainly definitely are part of a national coalition. And you're right, Amy, there have been sit-ins going on across the country. In fact, there's going on right now one in North Carolina, in Chapel Hill. We have solidarity across the country. We have solidarity within our own city. We're working with labor unions, staff here at the university, faculty, other community groups. It's really a broad coalition. And I think the mainstream media has unfairly tarred us as just a bunch of students out to recreate the 60s. We're out to change the world. That's what we want to do.
Well, James Cook, I want to thank you for being with us, one of the students at the University of Arizona, Tucson, who has staged a sit-in at the campus administration building over the use of sweatshop products. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Schools across Jefferson County, Colorado, reopened today for the first time since Tuesday's bloodbath. But Columbine High School is a complicated crime scene that could take weeks to canvas and clean up. With the bodies of the 15 victims finally removed from the school, investigators turned their attention to the community, interviewing acquaintances, classmates, and relatives of the gunmen to find out why they did it and who else might be involved. Eric Harris, 18, and Dylan Klebold, 17, killed themselves in a second-story library after roaming the halls of their high school with sawed-off shotguns, semi-automatic rifle, pistol, and homemade bombs stuffed with nails and shotgun shells. They left behind such a pile of ammunition and explosives that authorities wondered whether they had help. And ironically, this action took place on the day that the Senate Assembly, that the State Assembly, was taking up the issue of liberalizing concealed weapon laws in Colorado. Authorities still aren't sure or aren't saying where the boys obtained their guns. They made the bombs from materials that could have been bought at most hardware stores. Classmates said Harris and Klebold were part of an outcast group called the Trenchcoat Mafia, that they wore black and spoke German to each other. They believed their choice of Adolf Hitler's birthday for the attack was no coincidence. Accounts from students indicated Harris was a leader, a boy who would come to class as if to war in steel-toed combat boots and a German cross, while Klebold was a follower. Jesse Boyer, a former friend of Harris, said he was surprised Harris criticized jocks because he'd liked sports. Boyer said he was an upbeat guy, but something changed. He associated himself with Nazis and listened to a techno-Nazi band. Students reported, who were running out of the building, that not only did the boys go after jocks, but also children of color. We're going to talk right now about the latest analysis on what happened in Colorado, and then move to what's happening this weekend around the country and around the world. And it is Mumia Abu-Jamal's birthday on death row in Pennsylvania, and there are major mobilizations planned. But first, we turn to Manning Marable on the issue of the Colorado shootings. Manning Marable is a director of Institute of African American Studies at Columbia University and editor of a new journal on Black politics and culture called Souls. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Professor Marable.
Good morning.
Your thoughts today about Littleton, Colorado?
Well, if Malcolm were here this morning, he would say that this is a case of the chickens coming home to roost. We live in a society that has been militarized beyond any levels imaginable. We have in the United States 1.5 million private, full-time and part-time, security guards. Between 1980 to 1990, the number of police in the U.S. doubled. We have more than 600,000 police officers in the U.S., and we have in circulation more than 300 million private, licensed, and unlicensed handguns. Now, in a society that is structured in militarization, and then if you add to that the 1994 Omnibus Crime Act pushed through Congress by Clinton, which allocated another $11 billion in matching federal funds to local governments to hire cops and to expand prisons, then young people are socialized in a society where they see the resolution of social problems being carried out through militarization, through the use of weapons, through force, through coercion. The young men who carried out this vicious and racist crime during their lifetimes in the last 17 and 18 years, we have built in the United States roughly 1,000 new penal facilities of various types, incarceration facilities. So they've grown up seeing the connection between the use of force, the omnipresence of arms. We've lived in a society that has reinforced racism and the connection between the use of coercion to suppress racialized minorities. It's not surprising that it has produced human beings that devalue the humanity of people of color. It's not surprising that young people are being manufactured who look to the gun as a way of resolving personality problems they may have with others, with other classmates.
Professor Marable, speaking of prisons, you're also involved in sponsoring a full-day conference tomorrow at Columbia University, part of the movement around the country on the prison industrial complex, Critical Resistance Conference we covered at the University of California, Berkeley a few months ago, as well as the Radical Black Congress that you were a part of in Chicago.
That's right.
Now, in addition to tomorrow's all-day event, which will culminate in a session tomorrow night on Mumia Abu-Jamal, on Saturday, there is a major mobilization planned for him in Philadelphia. Now, the 24th of April is not only the death row prisoner's 45th birthday, it's also the third anniversary of the signature by President Clinton of the Effective Death Penalty Act, designed to accelerate the pace of executions, to offer state courts unprecedented presumption of correctness, as they say, to shorten the deadlines for federal appeals, and for the first time in 200 years to weaken habeas corpus. That's the significance of this date for people who are heading to Philadelphia or are protesting in Rio de Janeiro or in California. Can you talk about this massive mobilization, what people are calling millions for Mumia this Saturday?
Well, throughout the world, there has been a campaign both driven by issues of morality and issues of social justice regarding Mumia Abu-Jamal. It is very clear to literally every observer in the world that Mumia did not have a fair trial, that the police and the state tampered with evidence, that there has been a rush to judgment and a rush to his death precisely because of the politics that Mumia represents, the fact that he is articulate, the fact that he is passionate for social justice, makes him a symbol that is necessary for the state to silence. I'm a historian, and I see in this case the pattern of state repression and political justice resistance to that oppression that one finds in the Rosenberg case in the 1950s, the Scottsboro Boys case in the 1930s, the case of Angela Davis in the early 1970s. All of the same kinds of issues from those historical events, those trials that pitted the state against progressive folk throughout the world, are here in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. So what we have done at the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University is organize what we used to call back in the older days a teach-in. We've created a conference that will be held tomorrow from 10 to 10 here in New York. Conference entitled Racing, RACE-ING, Racing Justice, Black America versus the Prison Industrial Complex. And we're looking at really five key issues: human rights violations in the prison system, black political prisoners in the U.S., racism and the death penalty, women of color in prison, And then the final plenary session in defense of Mumia, the political economy of race, class, gender, and social death. The last panel, which will be at 7 o'clock tomorrow evening at the Columbia Law School, will feature Ray Brown of Court TV, Minister Conrad Muhammad, the director of a movement for change, Len Weinglass, the lead attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal, Charles Ogletree from Harvard Law School. This is a conference that has generated the support of over 24 social justice, community-based, civil rights attorneys groups throughout New York City in the Northeast.
Professor Marable, I just want to say that in addition to that event that's happening in New York and what's happening in Philadelphia, where thousands are expected to converge from around the country, tomorrow a work stoppage is being planned by the 150,000-member teachers union in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, in solidarity with Mumia Abu-Jamal. And also on Saturday, longshore workers at all ports in the U.S. west coast of the United States will conduct an 8-hour work stoppage in support of Abu-Jamal's freedom. And in addition to Professor Marable, we're joined by Jack Heyman, who is executive board member of the San Francisco Longshore Union, which represents the dock workers at U.S. ports. Can you explain why dock workers have gotten involved, Jack Heyman?
Well, yeah, the International Longshore and Warehouse Union has been a union that's always been in the forefront of social causes. We understand that union contracts are why unions are in business, but beyond negotiating a collective bargaining agreement, our union has the tradition of paying attention to what's been happening in society. And as Manning Marable was talking earlier about what's happening to the quality of life in this country, it's becoming militarized. We also look at what's happening economically in terms of the number of homeless in the cities as becoming a landmark of as part of the landscape of this society. What's happening with the imprisonment of young black men? One of every four is involved in the criminal justice system in one way or another. And so when the question of Mumia Abu-Jamal came before us, we saw this in a very symbolic way. As this is what's happening to our society. More and more people becoming imprisoned, and those that speak out are being executed. And so we voted overwhelmingly at our Longshore Caucus, which represents 10,000 longshore workers on the West Coast, to shut down on Saturday to demand, one, a stop to the execution of Mumia, and two, for his freedom.
We're also joined by Michael Warren, a human rights attorney based in New York who's just returned from Geneva, where he held a news conference at the annual session of the UN Commission on Human Rights, and also has a good sense of what's happening in Europe around the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Michael Tarif Warren, welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning, Amy. How are you?
Very good. In just a second, we're going to have to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we'll come back to this discussion. But very briefly, why the news conference in Geneva?
Well, the U.S. has hastened to assert its own views concerning human rights violations of other countries around the world, and we felt it important to, since this is the month of human rights at the U.N., at least it was a month of human rights issues, and where different NGOs from around the world came and talked about human rights violations, that Mumia case be certainly presented to the Human Rights Commission at the UN for purposes of allowing that body and other countries to be aware of that case symbolically constituting gross violation of human rights in this country. And there are a number of people who were there at on the day that Zach De La Roca from Rage Against the Machine made a 5-minute presentation. That was on Monday, I believe, the 12th. And, of course, the press conference took place on the 13th when I arrived in Geneva for one day. And Zach De La Roca and myself and Roger Wareham from the December 12th movement, who made the room available and who, in fact, took part in the press conference and talked about the international implications, and I gave an analysis, a legal analysis, of the entire case, and Mr. De La Roca again talked about the statement that he gave the day earlier.
Michael Warren, hold that thought as we go to stations identifying themselves. Our guest, Michael Tarif Warren, a human rights attorney who's just returned from Geneva, Jack Heyman, executive board member of the San Francisco's Longshore Union, and Professor Manning Marable, director of the Institute of African American Studies at Columbia University, editor of new journal called Souls. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll finish up this discussion, hear from Mumia Abu-Jamal himself in commentary. Then we'll take a look at Clinton and Gore on the hot seat over global warming. And finally, get two commentaries from journalists Robert Fisk and John Pilger, one in Belgrade, one in London, about the hypocrisy and the bombing of Yugoslavia. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. Our guests, Professor Manning Marable of Columbia University, Jack Heyman of the San Francisco Longshore Union, and Michael Warren, human rights attorney who's just returned from Geneva, where the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal and the prison industrial complex was raised at the UN Commission on Human Rights. Michael Warren, what about protests in Europe around the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, who celebrates his 45th birthday on death row this Saturday, where millions for Mumia mobilization is being planned?
Well, Amy, I spoke, addressed the legal issues as well as the international law issues in a number of venues throughout France, for the most part. And in the south of France, in Montpellier, there was a large gathering in which I addressed a very diverse group of people who came out from Mumia. Some of those people will be a part of a French delegation that will arrive in the United States tomorrow, as a matter of fact. Approximately 60 to 70 people are the ones who cannot come to this country. They will be organizing their own event to occur on the 24th of April around Mumia's case. I spoke in other venues at Jussieu University in Paris, a large number of students who were supportive of his case. There was a press conference in Paris I participated in with Madame Mitterrand, the wife of the former Prime Minister of France, that was quite diverse and quite powerful. And there was a major, major demonstration and rally in Paris, and over 1,000 to 1,500 people took the streets and marched through the streets of Paris with banners, a very diverse group of people, wholly in support of Mumia, and of course I spoke at that rally that preceded the actual march and demonstration.
Hmm. As we look at the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, there are other developments around the country as well. This week, New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman and her attorney general conceded for the first time that some state troopers single out Black and Hispanic drivers on the highway, and that once they're pulled over, they were more than three times as likely as whites to be subjected to searches. They made the acknowledgement after years of denials from state officials. And as the New Jersey State Attorney General released the results of a two-month study of selected motor vehicle stops by state troopers, the study concluded that racial profiling had been conducted by some troopers in their zeal to stop drug trafficking. Overall, Professor Manning Marable, this issue of what's come to be known as driving while black, what is the significance of it for you in the larger examination of the prison industrial complex and how people wind up in prison?
Well, the personal significance for me is that about 20 years ago, driving on the New Jersey Turnpike, I was also stopped and searched by the New Jersey State Police Highway Patrol. So I know from personal experience that racial profiling has occurred by the New Jersey Highway Department for well over a quarter century. This is the same police that led to the shooting and then the legal persecution of Assata Shakur. So, you know, this has occurred in New Jersey for many years. What it symbolizes is that, as we used in our conference title for tomorrow at Columbia University, that justice is raced. That is to say, the structure of criminal justice reinforces institutional racism at a number of critical points. If you look in the prisons, who's in prison today? One-third of all prisoners were unemployed at the time of their arrest. Others averaged less than $15,000 annual income in the year prior to their arrest. Roughly one-half of all prisoners in the U.S. are African Americans. About a third of all black young men in their 20s, as we speak this morning, is either in jail, on probation, parole, or awaiting trial. These aren't simply abstract statistics. Those tie in with a kind of racial profiling that the New Jersey cops do, but is racial profiling within the structure of how justice is allocated unfairly by the system.
Finally, as we wrap up this segment, Michael Tarif Warren, having come back from Europe right now, and you're headed down, I know, to Philadelphia on Saturday for the mobilization, and you're one of Mumia Abu-Jamal's lawyers. Where are we right now specifically in the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal on death row now for more than 17 years? Could a death warrant be signed any day by the governor of Pennsylvania, Tom Ridge?
A death warrant can be signed at any time by the governor of Pennsylvania, but even going one step further, Amy, I believe Pennsylvania is probably the only jurisdiction that allows the warden of the penitentiary, if the governor elects not to sign the death warrant, to sign the death warrant. So even if Tom Ridge does not sign the death warrant, the warden of the penitentiary where Mumia is incarcerated can sign the death warrant, thereby serving as a legal basis in their mind for his ultimate execution. We are in a race against time as a result of the counterterrorism laws, effective death penalty act. It certainly, as you have indicated before, accelerates the amount of time for not only appeals but for habeas corpus. Habeas corpus has to be filed within 1 year of the complete exhaustion of state remedies. So the application that is being made today in the U.S. Supreme Court for certiorari relief is being made on the basis of three issues, and the failure of Mumia to have an effective legal counsel, the failure of the trial judge to allow him to participate in the trial, and the issue relating to the exclusion of black jurors. And of course, if that application is denied, since and given the fact that only 10% of the petition for certiorari are granted, then the lawyers have to be in a position to in the fall move for a writ of habeas corpus before a federal judge in Philadelphia. And if that is denied, and if evidentiary hearing is denied, or if an evidentiary hearing is granted and the relief is denied, then the other alternative would be to appeal to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals in Philadelphia. And if that is denied, the remaining issues would have to be raised in a further petition for certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court. And so it is actually a race against time. And that's why the international pressure is extremely important, and that's why, it, from a symbolic standpoint, it's quite important for those in France and other delegations from Italy and Spain and different parts of Europe to come here and join hands in hand with those individuals in this country who will come out by the thousands in Philadelphia and in San Francisco in support of Mamia Abu-Jamal's right to obtain a new trial.
Well, I want to thank you all very much for being with us. Michael Tarif Warren, rights attorney in New York, Jack Heyman of the San Francisco Longshore Union, and Columbia University professor Manning Marable, who is also editor of a new journal on black politics and culture called Souls. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!
My name is Mumia Abu-Jamal. I'm a journalist, a husband, a father, a grandfather, and an African-American. I live in the fastest-growing public housing tract in America. I've been a resident on Pennsylvania's death row for more than 15 years. American mass media is a marvel of technology. It is whiz-bang, sparkle glitter, and satellite wizardry. It is a master plan of methods to communicate in a pauper's worth of substance. With such technology, how are people so woefully misinformed? The average American neither knows nor cares about the vast world beyond the nation's border. The average American student knows little math, no history, and very little geography, and nor does he or she want to know. Americans have computers in school, dozens of TV stations, and the most aggressive news media on earth. Does that mean they're better informed? Hardly. On November 2nd, 1995, the United Nations General Assembly voted overwhelmingly, 117-3, to condemn the United States for its continuing blockade of Cuba. The international community called the United States blockade a flagrant act of aggression and a blatant violation of international law. That the UN vote was reported at all in American media is amazing, for such news is more often than not passed over entirely by the American press. But where was information about the blockade itself, the effects suffered by the Cuban people, in-depth comments from United Nations delegates and leaders around the world? For a more substantive report, one had to listen to the BBC World News Service, for the rest of the world takes note of events the U.S. prefers to ignore. American media is a business, and it has a mission, not to inform Americans, but to entertain them. Every media enterprise in America reports the drivel that Marcia Clark and Chris Darden are secret lovebirds, but the vote of a global assembly condemning U.S. actions received only scant coverage at best. Why? The media is a source of titillation more than information. The mission of the media is to please, to comfort, and primarily to sell. When TV was developed, it was promised that every American would learn about the world in his living room. When computers were developed, wasn't it said that they would be invaluable learning tools and that children would learn more faster? National scholastic tests show otherwise, as kids master computers as toys and learn splendid hand-to-eye coordination, but little else. The media paints false pictures of the nation and the world, pictures designed to serve corporate masters and to make America look good. This feel-good media approach serves the American delusion of white supremacy, but it does not inform. When the New York Times echoes the National Star, what can the word media mean? How could millions be surprised at Minister Farrakhan's enormous influence among blacks unless the media wasn't doing its job? How could they look at a million and count less than half that number? The major media, like its racist projections, is to be rejected, not consumed, for your very patronage gives it life. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
And you are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! The number for the Millions for Mumia mobilization that will take place on Saturday in Philadelphia is 215-476-8812. That's 215-476-8812. Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania, the state where Democracy Now! Was taken off all 12 stations owned by Temple University the day we began to air the commentaries of the death row prisoner. Well, we're going to move now from the issue of the prison industrial complex to the environment. Today is Earth Day, and President Clinton has scheduled a news conference to announce new air quality standards. But while Clinton is getting some praise from environmental groups for this new move, he and Vice President Al Gore are on the hot seat for their environmental record on other issues like global warming, the conservation of forests, and their continued support for loosening up environmental controls on corporations. Just last week, Clinton responded to a letter from a coalition of environmental groups that accused the White House of having broken their pledge to reduce pollutants that cause global warming. The groups expressed deep disappointment with the administration's track record on the environment. Clinton's letter, in turn, defended Gore's commitment to the environment, saying, quote, "No one has done more over the past decade to mobilize action against climate change than Vice President Gore." One of the signatories to the letter is the National Environmental Trust in Washington, D.C. We're joined now by Peter Kelly, who is spokesperson for the group. Can you tell us how significant this letter is, Peter Kelly?
The letter from the national environmental groups that you're referring to, which went last week to Vice President Gore, was the first time that the leaders of so many national groups had put themselves out publicly as criticizing this administration for failure to follow through on its promises to cut global warming pollution. And typically this kind of thing is conducted, you know, in meetings with the administration. The deep disappointment that's referred to in the letter would not be necessarily released to the press. But in this case, the fight was taken public because we are seeing so little action to go along with their promises on global warming.
We're also joined by Peter Montague, editor of Rachel's Environmental and Health Weekly, which is a newsletter that deals with environmental justice and health issues based in Annapolis, Maryland. Peter Montague, your assessment of the Clinton-Gore record on the environment.
I would say that the Clinton administration has a really pathetic record on the environment. They have basically given away the store to the corporate polluters over the last 6 years. They have paid lip service to clean water and clean air, but when it comes to real action, they have loosened the controls on the major sources of our problems, which are the large corporations.
Talk more about the large corporations.
Well, for example, let's take Monsanto Corporation, the company that brought us Agent Orange, PCBs, a large portion of what we call chemical agriculture. They've now put a bovine growth hormone in the nation's milk supply. And the Clinton administration is bending over backwards now to help them expand their experiments in biotechnology around the world. So the Clinton administration talks a good game about cleaning up air and water, but the actual facts are that they are doing their best to loosen all controls on large corporations like Monsanto, which are frankly conducting large-scale experiments on humanity and on the entire global ecosystem.
Next week on Democracy Now!, we'll be speaking with the editor of The Ecologist magazine, who is coming to this country for the first time around the issue of global warming. But they did an issue of The Ecologist on Monsanto. Ultimately, the printer of that magazine ripped up all the editions, and no one ever got to see the edition on Monsanto because they were so afraid of a libel suit. In Britain, the libel laws are very much in favor of the corporations. Let's go back to Peter Kelly on the issue of corporations. You are involved with putting out a list of the Dirty Dozen, members of Congress with the worst environmental records, and I think that probably has a lot to do with campaign contributions. Peter Kelly.
Well, I should say I used to be involved in putting that out when I was at the League of Conservation Voters, and that continues to be the political arm of the environmental movement, and they're the ones who rate members of Congress on their environmental votes and put out the Dirty Dozen. Folks can get those profiles from their webpage. The work I do now is more focused on the environmental issues which members of Congress vote on once they get there, and we do see some of the worst enemies of the environment continuing to thrive and prosper in Congress. Just for an example, there's a piece of legislation that's going to be introduced next week by James Inhofe of Oklahoma. He's the chairman of the Clean Air Subcommittee of the Senate Environment and Public Works Committee. And he's planning on gutting the Clean Air Act and repealing the public's right to know about chemical plants in their neighborhoods. Specifically, they want to repeal the Bhopal provision of the Clean Air Act, which was put in there because of concern that, you know, we might face chemical release in this country that would kill thousands of people, as Dow's release in India killed thousands of people around Bhopal. The idea here is to notify people before it happens, to plan for such an eventuality, and hopefully to avoid it. And the excuse that's being given by James Inhofe and Tom Bliley in the House, who's chairman of the House Commerce Committee, the excuse they're giving is that terrorists will get this information and somehow use it to sabotage our chemical plants. Never mind that in the past decade we've had over 1 million recorded releases of chemicals from industrial plants, and not a single of one of those involved, much less terrorism, any breaking of any laws. You know, the excuse is disproportionate to the huge problem we have with the chemical economy in this country being conducted out of sight of the public.
Peter Kelly and Peter Montague, I'd like to ask you to stay on with us for a few more minutes, but I do have to break the show now for stations to identify themselves. Peter Kelly with National Environmental Trust in Washington. Peter Montague, editor of Rachel's Environmental and Health Weekly. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute.
Mother of us all, place of our birth, can we stand aside and watch the rape of the world this the beginning of the end this the most heinous of crimes.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we continue our discussion about the Clinton-Gore record on the environment, particularly important now as President Clinton stumps for Vice President Gore to be president in the year 2000, let's end up where we started on the issue of global warming. Our guest, Peter Kelly, Communications Director for National Environmental Trust in Washington, Peter Montague with Rachel's Environmental and Health Weekly. Peter Kelly, you described your group's problem with the Clinton-Gore record on global warming, talking about at best the vice president's inaction on the issue. What are the groups doing to change the Clinton-Gore stance on global warming?
Well, one thing we're doing is trying to point out to folks how these effects will show up in their own states and cities. We're going up and down the coasts of the country doing animations of how the sea level rise will actually affect the oceanfront real estate so that people can get an idea that this is an issue that will affect them. We're talking about how crop losses could follow changes in the weather that farmers depend on. And we're also pointing out the source of the problem, which starts with the coal-fired electric plants that were exempted from the Clean Air Act. I don't think we can have this conversation without pointing out that this morning, Vice President Gore and Carol Browner of EPA are in Shenandoah National Park promising to reverse the trends towards dirtier air over our national parks. This is a 22-year-old promise from the original Clean Air Act that the administration is now trying to keep. They're launching what's going to be a 60-year cleanup, which will start once again with these coal-fired electric power plants. Most folks don't know that we have power plants in this country generating over half of our electricity that burn coal. And that kind of a cleanup will help in meeting our global warming goals because as the electric industry is reformed, there are opportunities to move to cleaner power plants. But I have to say that it's being done in the context of a promise that was made in 1977 by the original Clean Air Act, and not in the area that the administration has committed itself, which is to seek out all the different sources of global warming pollution in this country and begin making real reductions.
Peter Montague of Rachel's Weekly giving you the last word.
Well, I have a slightly different take on the problem. I don't think that really the source of the problem is the coal-fired power plants. I think the source of the problem is the corporate power that allows the coal companies and the oil companies to purchase political power in Congress and in state legislatures, thus holding the American people hostage and undermining our democracy. You know, in the Constitution, there's nothing about corporations at all. Corporations don't exist in the original conception of American democracy. But over the last 100 years, these legal entities called corporations have gained phenomenal political power largely through court decisions that were made by judges who were not elected. So it's really been a corporate takeover of our democracy. And until the environmental movement focuses its attention on that and starts pointing out to people that together we really could make a difference about that and restore our democracy, until the environmental movement takes that fundamental approach, we're going to be tinkering with the deck chairs on the Titanic.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Peters, for joining us this environmental Earth Day. Peter Montague, editor of Rachel's Environmental and Health Weekly. Where can people get a hold of this newsletter?
They can call a toll-free number, 1-888-2-RACHEL, R-A-C-H-E-L, and we'll send you 4 free issues, and if you like it, then you can subscribe.
That's 1-888, the number 2-RACHEL. And Peter Kelly, Communications Director for the National Environmental Trust, where can people find out about your group?
Well, there are descriptions of our efforts on global warming and on clean air, and also the pictures that I described, pictures showing the sea level rise along the coast, and also before and after shots showing the air pollution that has settled over our national parks in recent decades. That's on our website at www.environet.org.
That's www.environet.org. Thank you very much for being with us. And today on this Earth Day, we continue to look at the bombing of Yugoslavia. In the last few days, we talked about depleted uranium and its use. We talked about the thousands of bombs dropping on Yugoslavia and what it means for the environment there, a country the size of Ohio, to have that many bombs drop, from the issue of depleted uranium to the bombings of oil refineries on the Danube, and what will it mean for the Greater Balkans. But today we're going to look at the issue of hypocrisy. The United States says that NATO forces were not targeting Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic despite an air attack on one of his homes. The Pentagon spokesperson Ken Bacon told reporters, "We're not targeting President Milosevic or the Serb people. We're targeting the military and the military infrastructure that supports the instruments of oppression in Kosovo." Well, today we're going to hear from two people on the issue of the bombing of Yugoslavia. And on this eve of the NATO summit celebrating the Western Alliance's 50th anniversary, Britain and France have asked their allies to consider the use of ground forces in Yugoslavia. Washington has signaled some flexibility and has agreed to review the options. In the last day, I've spoken to two journalists, one John Pilger. He is a British journalist well known in Europe, and also Robert Fisk, also British, but usually based in Beirut for the last 20 years, voted best correspondent, foreign correspondent by British editors and reporters for many years going. Well, he's been in Belgrade for the last month, and I talked to him about a lot of things, but today we're going to select out this part, and it's the issue of hypocrisy. He is not in Beirut right now, but he's talking to people in Beirut as he continues to cover the bombing of Belgrade, where he's based right now, and he talks about hypocrisy.
You know, you can see some very powerful similes the dispossession of the Albanians of Kosovo and the dispossession of the Arabs of that part of Palestine that was to become Israel in 1948, the parallels are very close. The destruction of villages, the trucking out, and the forced eviction of the people who live in those areas, the occasional massacres. Let's not make direct comparisons. It may well be the Serbs have done far more dreadful things than the Jewish and Israeli forces did in 48, or it may be the same. At the moment, it's impossible to tell. But we know there were massacres in Israel, or Palestine, as it then was, in 48. And similarly, just as in the aftermath of 1967, we had the Soviets or the Russians of the Cold War giving their moral support and their weapons support to Palestinian guerrilla groups because the Russians didn't want to be involved on the ground in the Middle East. So now we see Mrs. Albright and NATO and the Americans giving their moral support and no doubt their military support to the guerrilla forces of the Kosovo Liberation Army. And just as the Israelis called the Palestinian movements terrorists, the Serbs call the KLA terrorists. You know, the images of the Contras and the Bay of Pigs come to mind when I hear Mrs. Albright speak warmly of the KLA, when I hear American officials, Royal Air Force officers, Air Commodore Wilby in Brussels not long ago, speaking respectfully of how the KLA are not beaten, they are regrouping to go back into the attack. It's quite clear that the KLA are becoming the foot soldiers of NATO because, of course, we Westerners, we NATO nations will not risk our soldiers' own lives in Kosovo. We don't want to use ground troops. So you can see a very clear parallel, and suddenly we have President Clinton saying only a few days ago, the people who've been thrown out of their lands, their homes in Kosovo, have the right to return to their homes, they have the right to the homes, they must go back to where they came from. My goodness, you can see very clearly how the Palestinians who've been languishing in the Sabra Shatila camp in Beirut since 1948 are saying, well, we would like to go back to our homes in Haifa and northern Palestine, which is now Israel, if those Kosovo Albanians have Mr. Clinton's support to return to their homes in Pristina and Pech and Prizren, why can't we go back to Haifa? I'm told by my friends in Beirut, to whom I can talk from here, that this is indeed something that is being spoken out among the Palestinians. But of course, I don't think Mr. Clinton intends to support that other claim for return, only the claim which is being made by the Albanians here.
Well, Robert Fisk, I want to thank you very much for joining us from Belgrade.
Good night to you.
Good night. Robert Fisk is a reporter with the British newspaper The Independent, who in today's column has written about that comparison of the Kosovar Albanians and the Palestinians. Well, while NATO continues to pound Yugoslavia, yesterday destroying the main Belgrade residency of the Yugoslav president Slobodan Milosevic, five young people were killed in East Timor by members of a pro-Indonesian military armed by the Indonesian military, which in turn is armed by the United States and Britain. This just hours after independence factions in East Timor signed an accord with the Indonesian-financed and trained and armed Timorese militias. We turn right now to John Pilger, who is a well-known British filmmaker and author. His new book is Hidden Agendas, among his films, Death of a Nation, about the people of East Timor. And he makes the comparison of what the U.S., Britain, NATO is doing in Yugoslavia to what it's not doing in places like Indonesia.
Well, if there was any uniformity here, we'd have NATO bombing Jakarta. But that won't happen. They won't be bombing Istanbul either, or all the other places that the West and the U.S. support, places in which people are struggling for their freedom. And in Indonesia, the East Timorese, who have nothing actually to do with Indonesia in that they live close to it, have been struggling for their freedom there for 23 years. And because of the collapse of the Indonesian economy last year and the dictator Suharto's fall, the Indonesian establishment decided that it was best to get rid of East Timor, to let it off the leash. The Indonesian military didn't altogether agree with this because they occupy it. And they've invested a lot of time and blood, and they want to keep it. And what is happening in East Timor? East Timor is very similar to Kosovo. You have, except that East Timor is actually an illegally occupied territory. Kosovo is recognized as part of Yugoslavia. I mean, that, to Kosovars, that may seem a rather academic point, but it is a distinction. But otherwise, there are great similarities. Death squads raised by the Indonesian government are operating there, and nothing is really being said about this. There's no real pressure on the Jakarta regime from Washington, from London, to stop this, and they do have the clout to stop it, I believe. So the situation is very, very serious for the East Timorese, who are within sight of independence, and it may well be denied them by the Indonesians being allowed to raise death squads, paramilitaries, to create the kind of instability that will mean a referendum on autonomy and then independence will be virtually impossible.
And a major difference in the Balkans, perhaps, at least from the U.S. vantage point, the U.S. is less involved than in Indonesian East Timor, considering the U.S. and Britain are such major supplier of weapons to the Indonesian regime and could have absolute control over what happens in East Timor.
Well that's right. Indonesia, Britain is Indonesia's biggest supplier of weapons, from fighter bombers to machine guns. It's outside Saudi Arabia, it is Britain's biggest arms market. And that's a major element in all of this. Post-Cold War, the arms trade has become central to the economies of countries. It always was in the United States, and I suppose it probably always was in Britain. But in Britain, particularly, it's become a major ingredient in the so-called economic fortunes of the country. Thatcher restructured the economy and put the arms trade at the center. So 1 in 10 workers in Britain are now working for the arms trade. It's turning out a massive amount of arms and ammunition and bombs and missiles and tanks and so on and so forth. Of course, a great testing ground for these was in the Gulf in 1991, and it's in Serbia now.
John Pilger, journalist, documentarian, author of Hidden Agendas, which is published by the New Press, and filmmaker of Death of a Nation, about East Timor. John Pilger and Robert Fisk, just joining us from Belgrade, talking about hypocrisy, the bombing of Yugoslavia, and the countries that the West supports, like Turkey, like Israel, and like Indonesia. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of today's program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and David Love. Special thanks to Michael Eady. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. You can hear Democracy Now! Online at any time by going to www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!